The end of the article isn't the end of the story. The Journal podcast goes behind the scenes with reporters and covers everything from the Mormon Church's $100 billion fund to coronavirus. Listen to The Journal on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is your tech news briefing for Monday, July 13th. I'm Amanda Llewellyn for The Wall Street Journal. When you turn on your TV or open up your laptop, as the case may be, you've got practically endless options for what to watch. So many that there's just no way you could watch it all, even if you were stuck at home in a pandemic. Hollywood knows this, and some people in the entertainment world are integrating tech into the creative process. They're trying to make sure that they're making things that you want to watch. Our columnist Chris Mims will tell us all about it after these headlines. There was a bit of whiplash at Amazon on Friday. First, the company said that hundreds of thousands of its employees had to delete TikTok from their phones. That's because of security concerns. Then, just a few hours later, Amazon reversed course. A spokesman said that the company had sent the email, quote, in error. While it's not clear what's going on with Amazon, lawmakers in the U.S. have been calling for stricter regulations on the Chinese-owned TikTok. They say the app could be sharing user data with Beijing. The app has denied the allegations, and a spokeswoman said, quote, user security is of the utmost importance. And as the coronavirus continues spreading in the U.S. and around the world, researchers are racing to come up with a vaccine. Now, the process of making and testing a vaccine can take years, but one German biotech company says it's ahead of schedule. It's called BioNTech, and its CEO says it could be ready to seek regulatory approval for its vaccine as early as December. A reporter, Boyan Panchevsky, says BioNTech is using a relatively new technology called mRNA, and that it's a little different from a typical vaccine.
Now, a traditional vaccine would work roughly in the following way. Vaccines are made up of small inactivated bits of pathogens that cause diseases. They're introduced into the body into tricking it that it's being infected. They sort of cause a pseudo-infection, a low-grade infection that will prepare the immune system for the real thing when it happens. So once the body gets in contact with the real pathogen, there are antibodies and other immune responses that will protect it. Now, a mRNA vaccine works differently. It injects into the body proteins that will essentially reprogram the cells of the body into producing antibodies and other immune responses at a cellular level. This is, however, it's important to say, untested technology, technology that has not been used on humans outside of clinical studies.
After the break, how some entertainment studios are using tech to guide the creative process and what that could mean for the creative process. That's next.
When the world is at a standstill, facts can move us forward. Facts help us make decisions and bring us together even as we're apart. The Wall Street Journal has the facts in these uncertain times. Get the latest on the coronavirus outbreak with free coverage of the crisis and its impact on the economy, politics, culture, and daily life. Find the clarity you need with America's most trusted news source. Visit WSJ.com and stay informed.
You might have heard people say that we're in a golden age of television, but that also means that there are more shows and movies vying for our attention than ever before. And studios are now looking for any edge they can find to get ahead. Some are using tech to guide every stage of the creative process, from deciding what to make in the first place to making sure that content you'd like actually gets to you. Our tech columnist Chris Mims is back to tell us all about it. Chris, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I want to break this down to all of the different stages of the creative process. So let's start at the beginning with scripting and shooting, the actual making of the thing. How are we seeing tech implemented here?
So the amazing thing is, if I can take it back one step further, tech is even being used before anyone even decides to write a script. So in one case, a company that I talked to, which works with a bunch of major studios called MarketCast, basically a studio came to them with a so-called dormant piece of intellectual property, which just means some God knows what, you know, movie or comic book or show from a million years ago that everyone's forgotten about. And then they scour social media and they scour the web and they found out there's this big fan community and fan art. And they're like, actually, we think there is an audience for this. They can't disclose what it is going to be, but that is in production now as a major motion picture. There's also kind of audience testing with, you know, can we get more of this kind of superhero movie? Or, you know, I mean, the things that studio execs have been infamous for doing forever, which is like, oh, such and such work. So let's get more of that. Once you're at the scripting stage, you know, even when it's still in the writer's room, some companies then are hiring actors to do a table read of these scripts. They record that. And then they stream that to these online panels of volunteers who generally are compensated in some way. And they give feedback about the pacing, the likability of the characters, the dialogue, whatever, or whatever the important metrics are for that particular pilot or movie. And to be clear, there's this whole other industry. One company told me they reach a total of 1.3 million people per year who sit on these at-home panels. It's the at-home streaming version of what used to be the kind of focus groups that people would get pulled into, you know, if they're walking around a shopping mall somewhere or a casino somewhere. Now that that's all moved online, the sample sizes can be a lot bigger and they can have much more diverse and representative audiences. So you can say, I want this audience to be composed, you know, 1/3 of children below a certain age, 1/3 of adults within this range, and, you know, 1/3 something else, to make sure that that film hits all of its marks with all the intended audiences.
So it sounds like they're bringing the traditional focus group into the process earlier and earlier. So how does that play out when there's actually something on film? What does that look like?
Once they have shot any material or there's a pilot, of course, that's a very natural time to stream to these large online panels and get all kinds of feedback. And there's different mechanisms. So in some of these systems, which are built by startups like Pilotly, which is based in Oakland, it looks and feels like a normal video on demand system, or it can look and feel like a Facebook feed if the intended, you know, ultimate destination of that video is social media instead of an actual feature film. You know, they can pause the film at different points and pop up questions on the screen, you know, intended to assess how much people are enjoying it. Or there's these more passive feedback mechanisms where you can just like click on the corner and like, you know, heart, I like this, or thumbs down, I don't like this. And there's even a button you can click to say when you tuned out of the show. And then after the pilot, of course, they're given a more detailed survey about what they liked and didn't like, you know, why did they tune out? And then all of this can get digested into a narrative that is then given back to the creatives, the studio heads, you know, the directors, the producers, all those folks. And, you know, this can have massive effects on not just how a movie's edited, but the soundtrack. And then, of course, this same process is repeated yet again for trailers. And trailers can be some of the most data-driven, the most analytics-driven pieces of content that are put out there, because they can get cut and recut, and they can A, B, C, D, E, F, G test them for different audiences, just to see what are the most compelling versions of that trailer.
And of course, trailers matter because they're actually what gets people in the door to watch the movie. So after all of that's done, they've decided on, you know, a final cut of the show or the movie. It's about distribution. So how has this part changed?
So we've heard a lot about recommendation algorithms, and I think we've all probably read at least one piece about how Netflix, you know, was a pioneer in using big data and viewership habits. And the funny thing is that is the end of this cycle, but it is also the beginning, because what happens is once it's out in the world, all of our viewership habits are being analyzed, and that data is being fed back into that pre-scripting phase to determine what is going to get made next. So Breaking Bad does well. Okay, maybe you'll like Ozark. You know, Breaking Bad does well. Let's have a cast reunion film. You know, this particular type of moody drama is unexpectedly doing well. How can we produce more of those? You know, and of course, you know, studio heads have done that forever. But I think what's different now is, through all these analytics, they're able to get more granular about, well, you know, what people really like are, you know, these type of shows where the action hits within the first three episodes, because that's how you get somebody hooked for an entire season. Or, you know, people are really reacting to these kinds of moments within shows. So even if we are creating a completely different type of narrative and a totally different universe and what seems like a different genre, how can we pull in those elements that we know from our analytics have worked before? And a lot of what this is about is, it's not about creating the next Hollywood blockbuster, because of course those still exist. It is really about micro-targeting all of these different audiences as people's tastes, all of our tastes become more and more refined and we become more defined by them. So the same way that we are getting micro-targeted by Facebook's ad targeting algorithms, you know, as they follow us across Facebook and Instagram, Hollywood is really getting hip to how do you target even much higher investment, much longer term content in a similar way.
Yeah. And speaking of investment, how much are we actually talking about here? This sounds like something that would take a ton of resources.
It is still a relatively small part of budgets, which have just ballooned in general. So Netflix is spending $17 billion on original and acquired content in 2020. That's larger than Apple's entire research and development budget. And, you know, Apple is supposedly still working on a car and augmented reality and all the rest. You know, Netflix has said that they are willing to spend up to $10 million an episode, depending on the show. We know Amazon Studios has poured ungodly amounts of money into their new Middle Earth series that's supposed to come out. So we're getting these Game of Thrones level budgets for a lot of shows. I mean, I think as expensive as this could potentially be, part of the reason that it's getting used so widely is that because there's so much technology involved and because they have so refined the process of just kind of automatically slurping up these audiences and then streaming to them, and frankly, automating a lot of the evaluation and the analytics that results from their feedback, it's not nearly as expensive as it was in the old days to gather a real audience in a room somewhere. So they're kind of commodifying it and making it more accessible.
All right. Looking towards the future, is this kind of data-driven approach to creating art the future? And what does that mean for art?
That's such a great question, which I have thought about a great deal, because I came to the internet as a journalist and really as a blogger before I was even a journalist when Google Analytics was brand new. I remember getting into the beta of Google Analytics and being like, this is amazing. And then feeling 5 years later like it had ruined my life. You know, I don't know that anybody really has a grand answer to that. And I'm always suspicious of the motives of anybody who claims to have that answer, because it usually ends up being either this is ruining art or it's great because now we're giving the people what we want. It's wonderful how we've democratized the process of creating and distributing information and art. The only thing I can say personally, and I think a lot of us have experienced this, is that I am really kind of in awe of the ability of all these streaming services and these recommendation algorithms to, just when I think I've run out of stuff to watch, hand me that next little thing where I'm like, oh, wow, like this is really compelling. And this feels really micro-targeted to me. And how big of an audience could this really be netting? But I mean, the production values are amazing. I'll watch it. So I sometimes wonder if the biggest impact actually is that we're just all entertaining ourselves to death. On the other hand, there are worse things to be doing with ourselves when we all should be staying indoors as much as possible.
Fair enough. Our columnist, Chris Mims, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that was your tech news briefing. We've got more tech stories on WSJ.com, so check us out there. And if you like our show, please do rate and review us. It really does help. I'm Amanda Llewellyn for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.